Ladies and gentlemen, it's a great honour to be chairing, except we're standing, David this evening. His office as first civil service commissioner, a very great Gladstonian invention, makes him, I think, the first and therefore the most venerable of what we now call our regulators. Now, David's job, quite simply, I think, is to keep the twin flames of meritocracy and political impartiality alight and alive in the civil service. I like to imagine the wraiths, the ghosts of Sir Charles Trevelyan and Sir Stafford Northcote flitting through his rooms in Great George Street whenever he and his fellow commissioners are faced with an appointment that stretches them into the grey areas and might just require the speaking of truth unto power. I'm referring to the great Northcote-Trevelyan report of 1853, which laid down the basis of a career politically neutral civil service. The plan this evening, as Claire says, in this incomparable and sacred place, is for David and myself to have a conversation for about 20 minutes or so before opening out for a wider discussion, which can take us as widely as notions of public service and the nature of the civil service and its power that you want to pursue are. And also, I'm sure we'll get ever deeper into that fascinating governing marriage between transient ministers and permanent officials, with that valuable but occasionally vexing addition to the governing marriage, the special advisers, adding their own singular recitative. Now, David, let's start with your personal formation, if I can put it rather grandly. What drew you to the Civil Service Appointments Board, or CISB, as we called it then, in the early 1970s?
When you're 21, you're looking for a job, basically. And in 1973, I was looking for a job, and it was one of a number of things I applied for. I wouldn't like you to think that, I had my eye on the civil service from the start. There was a tradition of public service in my family, and I had a sense that I wanted to do something worthwhile, but it's no use pretending that at 21 I had a grand plan. I think it's not like that. I do remember applying for at that time you went through three stages. First of all, I failed the first exam, only got in as a sort of fastest loser. They decided they hadn't got quite enough over the pass mark, so they decided to put me over. And then I got through the next stage, and at the final selection board, these days don't have one, at the final selection board, I walked into a room in Whitehall with seven people around a table, and the first question was, if you were the Prime Minister and you had to get inflation down, what would you do? Well, I'm here to tell the tale, so presumably I made a stab at it, but my heart was beating fast.
Now, tell us a little bit about your public service tradition in your family. Did you carry in your head, as a recent graduate, a certain idea of public service, and what shaped it?
My father was in local government, so I suppose to some degree the conversations were about the local community and things you could do for the local community. I think that helped to shape it. It's difficult. I also went then to university in Oxford, and there was a great tradition of people from Oxford going into civil service in those days. It's just slightly discouraged now, but in those days people were encouraged to go for the exam. But I think it came from my father mainly.
Yeah. Even worse by today's standards, I think you read classics, didn't you?
Great. No. I read history.
Oh, that's all right. Yes, we're quite happy with that. At least I am. Did anybody formally teach you public service values when you joined the civil service? Or were you expected to absorb them through your pores by watching and listening to the older sweats?
I think you were supposed to absorb them through your pores, really. I mean, we did have very good training in those days. There was the Civil Service College. We had two 13-week sessions at the Civil Service College in successive years. But I think there was this sense of passing the traditions and values of the civil service down. I still think there's some of that now, that people sometimes think that somehow young civil servants are supposed to just to feel them. And there's always a risk, isn't there, that if you don't actually speak to people about the values that the organisation has, they might not feel them. But I certainly had a sense that they were being passed down to me in some ill-defined way.
I regret the passing of the Civil Service College. I don't know if you do.
I do, yeah.
Do you think we should get it back?
Yes, but it became the National School for Government, and then, unfortunately, it was wound up. I think that's a real pity, because I think the Civil Service College embodied a sense of a professional civil service abiding by certain values, and it passed that training on from generation to generation.
Yeah.
And I think it's a great loss, actually.
Yeah.
But, who am I to say?
Any particular individuals in the civil service, you might want to name them, who shaped you when you first joined the Department of Employment in 1973, at a time of very considerable industrial strife? I mean, it wasn't exactly a docile period for the Department of Employment, was it? But is there anybody who shaped you in particular?
I'm not sure I would single people out. The Department of Employment was in turmoil because it was a time of industrial relations strife and miners' strikes and so on. I'm not sure. I don't think there's someone I want to single out. There was a whole group of rather grand people in charge. But being the Department of Employment, there are also some people who, even in those days, had come from the north of England, which is where I came from. And, it was a place with quite a wide range of people, actually.
How's the relationship between ministers and civil servants changed since those days in the Department of Employment? I think it has in many ways, but you've lived through it. It's quite hard to pick it up, the changes, because you very rarely go over a visible benchmark or a tangible benchmark. But over those 30-plus years, the relationship and that governing marriage has changed, hasn't it?
Yes, I think you'd call it a governing partnership now, wouldn't you?
Well, you would, yes.
Yes. I think that, if I look back over all those years, and it's 42, in fact, I think that there was more mutual respect in those days between ministers and senior civil servants. There was more mutual trust and confidence, and I think some of that has diminished. And although it's never a smooth path, this, it goes up and down over the years, I think there is a trend of politicians particularly not trusting civil servants quite so much and not respecting them.
Why do you think that is? What's caused it? It's probably multiple.
It's something to do with the environment. It's something to do with the speed of politics, the lack of time to reflect and consider. I think it's something to do with that. It's hard to say. I mean, there still are those very... For a government department to work, there need to be excellent relationships at the top, trusting relationships, a guiding coalition of politicians and permanent secretary and senior civil servants. And there are still those relationships, and that's when it works. But I think it is breaking down a little bit. It's hard to say why.
One of our themes this evening, and it's our central one, is power, the notion of power of Whitehall. It seems to me that the civil service is less powerful now than it was in those days, not least because of the trust factor, but also because of the rise of special advisers and the multiplicity of think tanks. There were very few independent think tanks around in the 70s, and now they're everywhere. So alternative sources of advice. So I don't think the civil service ever had a monopoly. I think that was an exaggeration. But in terms of the geography of power, proximity to ministers, and the ability to get stuff in their red boxes, you were in pole position. Civil service still are, but not to the same extent.
And that's not necessarily a bad thing. I don't think that having a multiplicity of voices is bad for the development of policy, as long as the civil service retains its distinctive voice, which is one of objectivity, looking at the evidence, providing the properly analysed policy advice. I think that is what the civil service can bring to the table, but I don't think it would be good for democracy, actually, if the civil service had a monopoly of advice. It never really did.
No.
And I'm sure we'll come back to special advisers, but they come in all shapes and sizes. Some are like civil servants and just want to be policy wonks, and some are very, very political indeed and really want to be ministers. And then there's everything in between. And On the whole, if ministers didn't have special advisors, I'd want to create them. There's a little group of special advisors I wouldn't want to create, but on the whole, there's a group that is actually doing something which the civil service can't do. And I have been in situations where my minister for a while didn't have special advisors, and the greatest temptation is for the civil service to step in and become political. Mm. And I think that's a bad thing, and I think that that's why special advisors are needed. They vary, though.
Give us a quick character sketch of a special advisor who is a jolly good thing, and give us a quick character sketch of one who is not.
I've probably got a little picture in my mind, actually, but of course I won't put any names to it. I think a special advisor who is a good thing is one that, first of all, sets out to work well with the civil service, and secondly, retains their distinctive political view of things. It's no good a special advisor becoming like a civil servant. You might just well have civil servants. You want them to be distinctly political, and to bring that sense of politics and parliament to the table all the time, reminding the minister how they got into power, what their manifesto says. That's what you want, but you want them to do it in constructive partnership.
Mm. The other one?
Well, the other ones, it can either be someone who sets out to have a battle with the civil service for the ear of the minister and to do the civil service down, and there are those people. At the other end of the spectrum, there are the special advisors who are just like civil servants, as I say, and really that's no good either, because you want them to be political. Mm. It's a lot of the civil service and government is not any different from a lot of walks of life, where at the core of this is relationships. It's about good, respectful, trusting relationships. When it's about relationships, it works. Mm.
Do you think the big changes in 1979 in the House of Commons, when for the first time we had a set of select committees of MPs of all parties that shadowed individual departments, did change the calibrations? Because it meant that senior civil servants appeared far more frequently before select committees, because there were many more of them. There'd been the Public Accounts Committee before and just one or two. Mm-hmm. And also broadcasting, radio first and then television, meant that your profession came out of the cold. And it wasn't always easy for some people. Some people took to it quite naturally, which led them to be deeply suspect in their departments, occasionally, because you couldn't win. But do you not think that the nature of the governing marriage again, or partnership, changed when civil servants came out through Parliament into the public?
Well, it certainly became more difficult for civil servants in that they had to appear in public. They had to tread that line in front of select committees between being non-political, explaining government policy, but not stepping over the line to being the minister. I think there's some very, very difficult... And carrying the can, sometimes not landing your minister in it, all those things, I mean, it's difficult. The other side of this, I mean, there are some people here who've done more of these than I have, but some of the ones that I've done have become training exercises. I'd like to think in how to do it, but sometimes in how not to. And you do have a very torrid time sometimes. The bit of it that I think in the balance, it's a good thing, because I think it puts civil servants into the public eye to defend the implementation of their policy, which is their role. And I think, on the whole, government and democracy is better for having civil servants explaining why they did things and why they did things in a particular way. But in the 40 or 50 select committees and PACs that I did in my lifetime, I didn't always think that.
No, quite. Do you think the coming of freedom of information, many years later, admittedly, made another difference in terms of a surge of visibility / accountability of a different kind?
Most people like me regret freedom of information, of course, because it has become more and more difficult to give advice in private to your ministers. There's lots of things that you can put into the public domain, but the way in which the law has developed has gradually encroached on that private space between politicians and civil servants. I know most politicians who've been ministers think that, and most civil servants think that. The rest of the public, of course, do not. I feel that it is making it more difficult for us to be in that private space, which we need to be sometimes, advising ministers, talking over the options, and so on.
Yeah. Do you think that the case for a politically neutral career civil service has to be remade anew in each Whitehall generation?
I think so. I don't think you can take it for granted. I don't think we could take it for granted in my last 5 years as civil service commissioner. I think, again, the debates come and go, and the concept of an impartial, non-politicised civil service is remarkably resilient, actually. Mm. Everybody says, particularly after long periods of one party in power, they'll never be able to work for the next lot. But we always manage it, and manage it, I think, very successfully. But if you take the long view, I think there is a growing risk that there will be a more and more of a feeling that the non-political impartial civil service is not serving governments well enough. I think we saw it a bit in the last parliament. I don't think at this moment the non-political civil service is at risk, but I think there is more of a political debate about whether this model of a bunch of civil servants who serve this government and the next and provide objective advice, whether that is the model. I mean, I passionately believe it should be the model. I think it is the model. I think it's got a lot of resilience in it. But I think there have been little signs that there is less political acceptance of that than there used to be.
It's interesting, isn't it, that we live in an era now where a lot of this is written down as the ministerial code, which used to exist when we first knew each other as questions of procedure for ministers, a cabinet document, and therefore with a 30-year rule on it. Mm. So you didn't know the rule book for ministers. Couldn't know it because it was classified. Now it's the ministerial code and published. There's the civil service code, the special advisor code, plus the new cabinet manual. And I've heard it argued by some in the generation just a little bit older than you, that this was very significant, moving these tacit understandings, these conventions at best, onto the face of a code. But it was also a sign that the relationship was deteriorating, because in the old days, you didn't have to write it down. Everybody knew where the lines were. And Clive Priestley, you remember from the Cabinet Office, famously described it as the good chaps theory of government. Good chaps of both sexes, of course. And the good chaps, both ministers and officials, knew where the lines were, and they didn't transgress them. And there was a kind of built-in restraint which buttressed the confidence that you were talking about. So it's a funny thing, this codification. I'm actually in favour of it. I think it's necessary. We got to a point where it was necessary to start writing it down. But in some ways, it could be seen as a breakdown of the old relationship.
I don't think so, really. I'm always suspicious of these, of looking back to a golden age. I suspect there were lots of misunderstandings in that time, and I think probably it's better to have it written down. I think it leaves less room for doubt to have it written down. And I brought the Civil Service Code, 150 years of wisdom distilled in that. Actually, you can't get that anymore because it's online these days. But it's a remarkable document, yeah, in my view. And most civil servants, of course, never look at it. But if you want to and need to, it is a very brief, very clear, very compelling statement of what the civil service stands for.
Yeah.
And I think it's better written down. I want to say one other thing, though. I think that the most significant development in relation to the civil service of the last 20 years, 30 years, was the 2010 Constitutional Reform and Governance Act, which, yeah, put the civil service and indeed the Civil Service Commission and the values of the civil service into primary legislation. I used to think when I was a civil servant that that didn't matter, partly because there were lots of good chaps who could all be relied upon to behave themselves. But I've come to think from the role I have as first civil service commissioner that it's better to have it in primary legislation. I mean, a non-politicised civil service, an impartial civil service, there's no inalienable right for it to exist. But I'd rather have it guaranteed by Parliament, because then only Parliament can change it. Mm-hmm. And that means that if you're going to change it, you have to have a proper debate about it. You can't just change it as you could before with the stroke of a pen on the Ordering Council. So I think that the 2010 Act, which by the skin of its teeth, as you know, just before the prorogation of Parliament, was the civil service bits of it were put into law. I think that has been very significant.
How significant are these new extended ministerial offices? The idea, I think, is to have about just under 20 people, civil servants, special advisors, specialists. And I think four departments are working them up, and they'll have to come to you for approval of the senior positions, I think, as First Commissioner. How significant are they? Should we worry about them as possibly a central directorate coming up in departments which will marginalise the career officials? Or do you think it's building, it's going with the grain?
I think it's a really bad idea. Mm. I don't know whether people really understand what extended ministerial offices are. As you describe them, they're a bit like cabinets.
French cabinets.
Even European cabinets. Yeah. But yeah. Obviously, for obvious reasons, we can't describe them as cabinets, can we? But they are the idea that ministers have around them a much larger office, and there goes with that the personal power of appointment, which is not really... the convention is that ministers delegate their powers of appointment to civil servants. In extended ministerial offices, they do not. And that is a very significant change. However, in the way of our constitutional changes, it hasn't made any difference yet. These four extended ministerial offices have not changed the mould. They look like slightly larger private offices of the traditional sort, with special advisers and civil servants and one or two experts brought in, as has always happened. So it hasn't changed the world yet, but these things could be on a long timescale. These things very rarely change immediately when the people who are the progenitors of that change bring it into effect. It's often the next lot who don't remember why it was done but think it's quite a good idea to have a lot of a big office. And I think there are these two risks with it. One is that it blurs who are civil servants. I mean, if ministers can bring in people without competition to be civil servants, that changes the nature of the civil service at the margins. The other risk is that it becomes, as you say, a big office around the minister and the civil service at a distance. The model is you see it in Australia, in fact, where some ministers have dozens of sort of quasi-political civil servants around them, often in a different city from the civil service, often not in Canberra, and that does change the thing altogether.
Yeah. How crucial is the idea of a unified UK civil service, which we've had since time immemorial, and how sustainable is it, do you think, given the Devo Max to Scotland, and what I fear could be a creeping estrangement between Scotland and Westminster Whitehall, even if the countries don't separate?
Well, I think you and I probably share a deep commitment to the Union, don't we?
We do. So
my answer really comes from that. I think it is an essential part of the glue of the United Kingdom, and I think that the enduring values of the civil service are part of that glue. And I think it is very, very important that we maintain the ability to have a civil service which which shares the same understandings, the same approaches, and the same values all across the UK. I think it's immeasurably better. Of course, if we have independence, it'll break up. But until then, I think it's a good thing to have a unified civil service.
Is it fraying a bit? Is that glue weakening?
Well, it's fraying in the sense that you can't really get people in London to take enough interest in Scotland, I think. And I think that, you know, in a sense, the civil service has to work at the glue. I mean, it's much more interesting to be in Scotland if you're a Scottish civil servant these days. Mm. And so I think there's a lot to be worked at. I should tell you a story, though. I mean, as you know, the Prime Minister, and in Scotland the First Minister, now chooses their permanent secretary from a list of appointable candidates drawn up by an independent panel, which I chair. And we have not long since appointed the permanent secretary in Scotland. That was done by the UK Civil Service Commission. I had a lot of dealings with the First Minister. There was never any problem about that. And she said to me, as I was explaining the Scottish credentials of the candidate, she said, "David, they need to be good. That's what matters. They need to be good." Mm. And so I was pleased about that.
Absolutely. Do you have a sense, David, of the importance of the notion of Crown Service to the armed forces and the secret services?
Could you just answer?
The notion of Crown Service is very important to the armed forces because the Queen is Commander-in-Chief and all that.
Yeah.
And same with the secret services. I think they, in some ways, seem to cherish the notion of Crown Service because they're not classic, they're not civil servants, but it seems to be more powerful in the secret world and in the armed forces than perhaps it is in the Home Civil Service.
I think it is. I don't think you get civil servants in the Home Civil Service talking so much about being Crown Servants anymore. And it's a pity, really, because the connection of the civil service with the non-partisan bit of the Constitution actually expresses very clearly that the civil service serves the government of the day through the Crown. And I think there's something really powerful there, and maybe the Home Civil Servants here should refresh their thinking about that. It's absolutely true that the military and the security services prize that even more, and I think that's to do with their sense of their independent status, their non-partisan status. But maybe the Home Civil Service should refresh that.
Can you give us a swift audit of your hopes and fears about public service? Hopes first.
Well, the civil service, I'll talk about the civil service, I may, and the Home Civil Service remains a place of remarkable people, remarkable skills, and remarkable resilience. Mm. And we're very, very lucky to have it, because for the last 6 years, we have lost 80,000 jobs in the Home Civil Service. We've hardly given anybody a pay rise. There's been a lot of public debate about poor performance and so on, and yet the civil service goes on doing the job in the very best way it can for the benefit of the public, and we're very, very lucky to have it. And the greatest risk is that nobody recognises that. And nobody recognises that sometimes you can take things for granted until suddenly you realise that actually it's fallen into disrepair and somebody's thinking of changing it. You can't ever get people to speak up for the civil service very much. People aren't interested really in it. And I sometimes think the civil service doesn't stand up for itself enough. So I think just recognising what we have and making it as good as it can be, because this is not a plea for the status quo. The civil service, one of the greatest risks of the civil service is it doesn't do a good job. And that gives people who don't really care about it, the chance to say, well, it's not doing a good job, let's try some other model. So it does need to do a good job. But I think we're very lucky to have it. Mm. I would say that.
You would.
40 years, yes. You know.
Yes. Your nuclear weapon is resignation, because you report annually to the Queen. You're very independent. What would trigger your resignation?
As First Commissioner?
Yeah.
I'm not thinking of resigning, by the way. I think that if the government decided to make an appointment of someone we had said was not suitable and was not on merit appointable, that would be a resigning matter for me and the whole commission. But because I guess the government knows that, I don't think it will get to that stage.
Have you ever considered it?
No. And if I had, I wouldn't tell you
in this public forum.
I've had my ups and downs, as you know, in this 4 years. But
yes.
I think it's better to stay and stand up for what you think is right, actually.
Yes.
And, of course, I could do a lot of damage in the resignation. So,
yes.
But, you know, after 42 years, I know that taking on the government is a mug's game for somebody like me, because you always end up losing.
Interesting. If you were graduating this summer, would you put in for the civil service again?
Oh, yes, definitely. I'd be clearer now, of course, than I was in 1973, that it was a great place to work. You don't go in for the monetary rewards, but the other rewards of fascinating work, insight, if you're in Whitehall itself, into politics, the ability to do something worthwhile, something for the public, all those things are amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, they're absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
And although there are things in my career which haven't gone so well, when I've been pretty unhappy, mostly it's been worth it.
Well, David, you've given us a fascinating evening. Thank you very much indeed. Are we allowed to applaud in this wonderful place?
Yes.
We are.